from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. People have been out on the streets of this nation for several days now, sparked by the actions of a policeman who suffocated George Floyd with his knee and killing him last Monday. The airwaves, cable television, and social media are being flooded with fragments, images, unconfirmed claims, real-time video with important context just beyond the frame's edge, and powerful counter-narratives pushing back against official accounts. So who controls those narratives? How do they shape the nation's collective understanding of this profoundly difficult, profoundly important moment? This hour on Point, the nationwide protests and how the media is covering, framing this story, and sometimes even becoming part of the story. And we'll begin today with Michelle Norris. She joins us from Washington. She's an opinions contributor for The Washington Post and founding director of the Race Card Project and author of The Grace of Silence, a memoir. Michelle, it's so wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Meghna, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And also with us is David Folkenflik. He is NPR's media correspondent and, of course, On Point co-host as well. David, it's good to have you.
Great to join you.
So, Michelle, let's start first of all with just sort of where is your head today, right now, after experiencing and witnessing what's been happening across this country for so many days?
You know, it's funny you asked me that because I was actually trying to find the right verb to describe how I feel. And I think riven maybe is the right one. I'm from Minneapolis, so it has been soul crushing and heartbreaking to follow what's gone on there, beginning with the death of George Floyd. I am so tired of seeing Black death on small screens with alarming regularity. And then to watch the city I love go up in flames and then watch it spread throughout the country and now throughout the world as people are taking to the streets. I just saw, overnight they were out in the streets. People are out in the streets in New Zealand. And to understand that there's no balm that we can easily reach for right now, because what is driving this, and I'm not speaking of the outside agitators who are coming in from out of state to kick this up for their own nefarious reasons having to do with anarchy or chaos or civil disturbance. I'm talking about the core protesters who are usually protesting with anger, but although peacefully for the most part. They are seeking something that they have not seen, and that's justice. And they've seen case after case after case where these cases are not adjudicated in a way that feels anything like justice. And it feels like we've reached a turning point where it's going to take quite a long time to let the pressure out of the pot here so that people will feel that they don't need to take to the streets.
Well, if I may, I just want to play a moment from CBS's Face the Nation yesterday, because Michelle Wesley Lowry, a Washington Post reporter, was on CBS making a very similar point to what you were just talking about. And here he is.
Every time we open our phones or our computers, we being all of us, we watch another video like this, right? And for years, it's been these pleas from elected officials, from policing officials, from the media, from everyone. Well, if you guys just calm down, I promise we'll fix it. We promise we'll fix it. We'll have a meeting. We'll have a town hall. Someone will give a speech.
That's Wesley Lowry, a reporter for The Washington Post on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday. David, I'm going to come to you in a second, but Michelle, will you just elaborate a little bit for us on this, because it's so very important that this isn't just something that sort of erupted overnight. The pent-up desire for justice that has not been met, as you said, we're in a long haul here towards some kind of healing.
And it's a maelstrom of several things. It is the long daisy chain of names: Trayvon Martin, Ahmaud Arbery, Walter Scott, Eric Garner, Rakesha McBride. I mean, it just, that list is too long. And in most cases, we saw those people expire before our eyes. Philando Castile right there in Minneapolis. So you have that. you have a moment of great political tumult. And let's remember that we're in the middle of a global pandemic. So people are feeling economic uncertainty. And that's probably the nicest way to say that.
Right.
Their jobs have been snatched from them. In many cases, the same community that is in pain, direct pain, because they're worried about their own safety, in addition to watching these videos, have also buried too many of their loved ones, mm-hmm. because the Black community is also in the bullseye of the pandemic. And as I said, the response to this has not matched the macabre nature of what we're seeing. It's not just George Floyd. And it's almost, if you reach back, this is almost always what happens. If you reach back all the way back in the 1990s to the riots, to the uprising in Los Angeles after the Rodney King riots, mm-hmm. if you lived in on the West Coast, if you spent time in Los Angeles, you knew that that had as much to do with LaTosha Harlins as it did with the Rodney King beating. It had as much to do with aggressive policing and battle lamp policing under the former police chief Gates as it did with what happened. So there's this tinder, this kindling that that has created the right environment for the fire this time. Mm-hmm. And we have to figure out as journalists how we examine not just the unrest, but the roots of unrest, so we can unspool this and try to figure out a better path forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So, David, thanks for being so patient there. Jump in your first thoughts here on six very difficult days in America.
Well, I'll always be patient listening to Michelle Norris, our beloved former colleague from NPR. It's an honor to join once more on the show with. Let me say this, I think Michelle has exactly right. It's a question of, where we point our lens figuratively and literally. What images are we capturing? What moments are we presenting as not just a fact, a data point, but as a truth or as an overwhelming narrative? Where do we start the story? You know, if my kids get into a bit of a fight or a tussle and somebody says she slapped me, I'll say, what happened before that? What else should we know about what's going on? I also try to get them to resolve it themselves. But this is, a much more serious moment. It is a moment of, it's almost too much to process for the public and too much to process for the press. We have three crises, right, where there's been this explosion of protest and at times violence against the accretion of incidents which lay bare the fact that there are systemic inequities in our criminal justice system and in some ways in our body politic. There is, of course, the economic crisis, not a modest one, a quarter of the nation out of work, probably more, and more to come. And, of course, there's a global pandemic, so people have been penned up, unable to commune, unable to do things and express things and have outlets and have the ability to say, lobby in person for the past few months about things that affect them, including these kinds of issues. So, people are coming out and expressing themselves, and we've got to process as the press what we're presenting to the public. And, journalists aren't historians, but we really need to figure out context. Journalists aren't sociologists, but we have to figure out how culture works. Journalists aren't psychologists, but we have to figure out how people are feeling and hurting and processing on all sides of this. And journalists are part of the story themselves, as we've seen, and we can talk about that more later in the show, but in ways in which they've seen hostility directed at them occasionally by protesters, but more tellingly and more complicatedly in some ways by people acting with the color of authority, by police officers and law enforcement officials in various parts of the country.
Yeah. Well, listeners, we are talking this hour with both Michelle Norris and David Folkenflik about what has happened over the past several days across this country and now in other places around the world, and also how media is shaping our understanding of this profoundly complicated, difficult, and important moment. So how do you think the coverage has been so far, listeners? What stories are you seeing on TV, hearing on the radio, or seeing on social media? Do you think there are places where powerful counter-narratives are emerging? And if you witnessed some of the protests, tell us whether the reporting you've seen got the story right. Michelle, I wonder if I can turn back to you because you said something, well, you said many things that I think are profoundly important, and that is the obligation that we have to get at a deep understanding of the roots of the problem. So in a small attempt to take a step in that direction, can you tell me more, at least start to, because we've just got a couple of minutes before our first break, but tell me more about Minneapolis and growing up there and your understanding of what led to this moment in this city?
Well, I grew up actually 10 blocks from where this happened. This is a neighborhood that I know very well. When my parents got divorced and my mom and dad separated, my mother purchased a house that was 2.5 blocks from here. I know this intersection quite well. And most people think of Minneapolis as a social nirvana. And in many ways it is. Minneapolis has shaped me in profound ways because of the tolerance and the integration that I remember. But what has happened in more recent years, in the past two decades, is that Minneapolis has actually become a very segregated city. It has among the lowest level of home ownership. It has many more segregated schools than I remember. And it has racially isolated and economically isolated neighborhoods. And it also has one of the highest levels of police living outside of their community. For I think it was 2015, only 4% of police in Minneapolis actually, 6% lived in the city, 94% lived outside the city. And all of that creates sort of these undercurrents that can help create a situation like we saw at the corner of 38th in Chicago. Mm.
Well, Michelle Norris and David Folkenflik, stand by. We'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're trying to begin to get a handle on where the nation is, given the past six difficult, but profoundly important days in this country. I'm joined today by Michelle Norris. She is an opinions contributor for The Washington Post, founding director of the Race Card Project, and author of The Grace of Silence, a memoir. And many of you know her from her previous work with NPR as well. And David Folkenflik joins us. He's NPR's media correspondent and On Point's Friday host, my co-host here at On Point. And I just want to, before I let too much time pass by, I just need to quickly issue a correction. Earlier in the previous segment of the program, when we played a little bit of tape from CBS's Face the Nation, I had said that Wesley Lowery was a Washington Post reporter. That was true in the past. He's a former Washington Post reporter. He is currently a correspondent for 60 Minutes program 60 in 6 on Quibi. So he's now with CBS. So my apologies for that. But Michelle, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more, again, using Minneapolis as an example of how, in moments like what we're collectively experiencing now, there's this incredible pulse of attention being paid almost at every level to unrest, unhappiness, and perhaps even the attention being paid to the deeper problems that are being revealed. But part of the issue is that maybe we're not paying that same amount of attention when people aren't in the streets, right? I mean, what were there signs in Minneapolis? Obviously, there have been beforehand that we should have paid closer attention to.
Oh, of course. Of course. And it wasn't that no one was paying attention. I mean, the local media was covering some of this, that the University of Minnesota, St. Thomas, their schools where they've been studying this sort of demographic shift and this economic chasm that has appeared in this part of the world, which was really known for being the land of 10,000 lakes and extreme tolerance. But there's also been a long chain of extreme policing, most of it targeted at people of color, at Black and brown individuals. And there is a lack of trust right now in the police department. And even though a lot of people actually hold the current police chief, Arredondo, in high regard, it doesn't mean that they hold the police department in high regard. And it's because of what they've seen with Philando Castile, which did not happen in Minneapolis, but people nonetheless see that, you know, and it affects their view of policing overall. And with Jamar Clark, another, you know, high profile case, and they see what happens to the police in these cases. They're usually acquitted. They see what happens when they look at patterns and practices, where the kind of chokehold that it not exactly was used in the killing of George Floyd, but chokeholds in general are almost always directed at people of color. And they see the response now to the rioting and the unrest, which on day one, this happened on Monday night, by Tuesday, the police were already responding with riot gear, with tear gas, and with rubber bullets. And there's a whole body of research that shows that protesters often respond based on the way police respond. So they almost got the response that they expected by showing up in riot gear, and a peaceful protest very quickly became quite riotous.
Mm. Well, I'm also wondering about, for example, and I'll be honest, in 2007, I did not know about a particular complaint that was filed by a group of Black police officers in Minneapolis alleging discrimination in the department there. There's been some reporting just in the past couple of days sort of digging up this 2007 complaint. And in that complaint, the plaintiffs alleged that that Bob Kroll, who's the current president, I believe, of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, openly wore a white power patch on his motorcycle jacket. I mean, those are the kinds of things. Should we have been paying closer attention all along?
Oh, I would say yes. And I will note that of the five, I think they call themselves the Mill City Five, among the plaintiffs in that case was the current police chief. So you can imagine the internal tensions in the department there. But this is a case where, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about race and racism in America. And when you overlook a case of racism, you know, if this was someone who was wearing a white power badge, that's something the department should have looked into. And when you don't look into something like that and you don't address something like that, then at the very moment where you need trust the most, the community doesn't trust you, because they said, you let this pass for years. And this says something about the culture that is accepted in the department. So when the city officials, Governor Walz, Mayor Clark, Mayor Fry, the head of security, Harrington, were appealing to people to follow the curfew, to stay home, to trust us. Trust is earned. And for some people, it was hard to trust them because of the patterns and practices that they had seen within the department. Mm. That's why it's so important to meet that head on and to control your culture in ways that you can, because otherwise people won't trust your culture at the moment that you need it.
Well, let's go to our callers. Let's go to John, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Yeah. So, you know, this whole conversation about policing and talk about narratives and things during the protests in Richmond on Sunday, what you have to realize is, like she said a minute ago, people come at it at the energy that the police will come at you with. And literally, we were kneeling with our hands in the air and the police threw tear gas at us unprompted. So they are provoking the violence. They also use their cars to ram into people. And there are videos of that on Twitter. And not only in Richmond are they using their cars as weapons, but in New York. Mm-hmm. You have to realize, why did these people come out here as if it's a war zone? There are tanks rolling down our streets. And in any other country, they compare this to Tiananmen Square. But because it's Black people doing it, it's a riot.
Yeah. Yeah. John, thank you for that call. David, let me turn back to you. John makes the point, and it's absolutely right, that people are, some of them are experiencing this firsthand, and many millions more are seeing images of exactly what he's talking about, whether it's on social media or television as well. What impact is that immediate spreading of those moments and those images having?
I think it's huge. I think it's you know, you think of police departments as being the authorities, right? As being the folks who are going to offer an authoritative version of what has happened. But time and again, when we've had things like videos, the George Floyd case, just the most bitter recent example of that, it put the lie to the official account. It showed that the way in which police said he died was not actually accurate or fair to the facts, and that the combination of the conventional press's abilities to put things out almost instantaneously with and social media's ability to have people, you know, information in the hands of witnesses and participants able to share that with the broader public, it's very telling. You know, you had a reporter of color for CNN being arrested live on the air, plainly civil, solicitous, in fact, of the police, making clear that he and his crew just wanted to know where to go, and police essentially putting him in handcuffs, even as a white colleague was not. It was a very telling moment. What was, to me, even more astonishing was that the state police of Minnesota put out a statement saying that as soon as the journalists identified themselves as journalists, they were released. Well, that was belied and disproved before it even happened, that statement, by the video that CNN had been contemporaneously at that moment broadcasting to the world. So I think that the power of video and of people to witness what is occurring as a check on versions of events is incredibly important. And I think it's part of, you know, it's hard to know why this is happening. And you certainly have seen at least two instances of seeming hostility toward the press, right? There was the defacement and vandalism at CNN's headquarters in Atlanta, which sort of subsumed in antagonism between protesters and police down there. And also there was a Fox reporter who essentially hustled out and assaulted near White House grounds by protesters there. But there have been a number, just almost countless number of instances in which police and law enforcement officials have acted in a very aggressive way towards journalists who are identifying themselves. You had a reporter for the Los Angeles Times who seemed to be hit at very close range by a tear gas canister, causing a gaping wound in her leg. You had a woman who was a photojournalist in Minneapolis who had driven up from Tennessee to chronicle what was happening, who had a rubber bullet, she said, that hit her right near the eye. She said that she lost all vision in her eye permanently, in her left eye permanently. You had a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who said he was hit repeatedly in the face with a riot shield by a police officer in New York City. Another reporter, while identifying himself clearly as a reporter, another reporter for the Huffington Post taken into custody and forcibly arrested, although clearly identified as a reporter. And these are just a small scattering of the instance around. The question that arises, although we don't have answers, we don't know if there's just so much tension and anxiety that people are kind of freelancing and doing things out of nervousness, or if there's some notion that the reporters are chronicling what's happening. It chronicled what happened in George Floyd, and four officers are fired. One's under arrest. Others are under investigation. We don't want there to be witnesses who are seen as credible chronicling what's happening right now. I think there's a real tension there, and all protesters have the right for self-expression and freedom of assembly, but reporters have typically been given more leeway if they are being assaulted or treated in this way. Imagine ordinary citizens who don't have major institutions like CNN or the Los Angeles Times or the Wall Street Journal behind them. How are they likely to be treated when the cameras are off?
Well, I just want to play two moments of how some reporters have been treated in the past few days. Here, for example, is a moment where a reporter in Minneapolis described what happened.
Well, I don't know. I'm bleeding from on the side of my eye. I'm bleeding on my arm. Cops just shot my window out, my passenger side window out. The glass shattered as I tried to quickly turn and get out of their way. My name is Ryan Faircloth. I'm a reporter with the Star Tribune.
And David also mentioned when CNN correspondent when the CNN correspondent and his crew were arrested while they were on live TV covering the protests in Minneapolis. And here is that moment.
Wherever you'd want us, we will go. We were just getting out of your way when you were advancing through the intersection. So just let us know and we got you. I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir? Why am I under arrest, sir?
That's CNN correspondent Omar Jimenez being arrested live on television. He was just standing, filing a report. Michelle, jump in here, especially for journalists of color reporting on this moment. How are these instances, what impact is that having?
Well, let me just first take just journalists. It's important to point out that journalists are being targeted all over the country. And it's questionable that this seems to be happening all over the country. But it also should be said that no one should deserve this treatment. Being tear gassed, pepper sprayed, mm-hmm. targeted with rubber bullets, stun grenades. A KPCC reporter was hit in the throat with a rubber bullet and posted a picture of himself with a wound that looked, you know, awfully gnarly. It's a moment coming out of this for police, for law enforcement to really think about what story they want to tell about themselves. I mean, I would hope that this would be a very introspective moment for law enforcement in America. I'm not sure it will be, but I hope that it would. I have members of my family who work in law enforcement. Mm. For journalists of color, this is a moment of vertigo. It is a moment of deep pain. You bring objectivity to your work, but you also know that you're covering a story that directly impacts you in a very particular way and impacts your sons and your daughters, impacts members of your family, because you worry about your own safety. If we've all heard about giving our sons and daughters the talk about how to comport themselves if they should be pulled over by a police officer. So they bring a different lens to this story, but also a different level of pain when you're a journalist of color. And particularly, you know, for people who've been covering this over and over and over and over again, you played a clip from Wesley Lowery, who was at the Post and now is at CBS, who talks about this quite openly because he understands the need to have a space for journalists to unload about this because it is so visceral and so deeply painful. And it also plays out in the way that our audience watches this. So there is an audience that will watch this and will understand the deep level of pain. And people talk about anger among the protesters. I hope that people understand that it's also anguish, mm-hmm. that people are just exhausted and they're just, you know, their soul is hurt by this. And there are people who will watch this and they will see the police in a completely different way because they're allowed to, because they live in communities where the police are there to protect and to serve. They live in communities where the police officer is a largely benevolent figure. And I'd like to get to a point in America where all of us could perhaps see law enforcement with that point of view. I really, really wish for that. But for many communities, particularly communities of color, that is not their understanding because of profiling, because the high rate of people being pulled over for all kinds of questionable reasons. And because we all know that, you know, whether you're driving while Black, whether you're jogging while Black, whether you're bird watching while Black, you know, there are any number of things that carry a higher level of peril when you attempt to live your life in Black skin, mm-hmm. and now practicing journalism while Black, you know, can be added to that list.
Right. David, we've got about just a minute before we have to go to our next break here. It has to be asked, though, in addition, for the past several years, we've had the President of the United States repeatedly, you know, tar the press as being the enemy of the people. That can't help in this moment.
I think it's inflamed it. I think it's for those who are reacting to the protests and to some of the violence that they see and not thinking about what preceded it, they can embrace the press as just sort of hyping what they see as inconvenient or unpleasant or distorted facts. And I think it's not an accident also the president for those years not only has gone after reporters but particularly singled out reporters of color and tried to delegitimize them and their questioning and their reporting, particularly African-Americans, but not only African-Americans. And I think that that combination is sort of a bit of a toxic stew when it concerns how the public, or at least part of the public, thinks about the journalists doing their job.
Well, we're talking about where we are now after days of anguish and anger and unrest. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking stock of where we are as a country after many days of anguish and anger and upheaval in cities across the United States. And we're also talking about how the media's coverage of profoundly difficult but profoundly important moments like this shape the narrative, shape our understanding of what's happening in America. I'm joined today by Michelle Norris. She is the founding director of the Race Card Project and an opinions contributor for the Washington Post, also author of The Grace of Silence, a memoir. David Folkenflik also joins us as well. He's NPR's media correspondent and On Point co-host as well. And let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Anne, who's calling from Rockville, Maryland. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to speak about one observation that I found while I was looking for articles to try to show me what was going on. I noticed that in the American newspapers, or I subscribe to digital ones, there were always pictures. In fact, I thought that it was only black people rioting and setting fires to the police station. There were only black people shown during violent things at night. And when I had to go to foreign newspapers to find humanizing photos of peaceful protesters in the thousands during the daytime, way before any of this violence occurred at night, humanizing photos of black people in general, and I couldn't find these in American newspapers. I was like, why aren't these articles being shown, or these photographs, why aren't they making it to print in American papers? It's not just black people that are out there risking their lives as well. It's the photos in foreign newspapers are unifying. They show people in Berlin, thousands of people in Germany in front of the American embassy there chanting Black Lives Matter. I mean, it seems like the American newspapers are more polarizing in the images that they present, right? Because people are going to look at the pictures first. You see all this violence and ugliness at night, none of the unity during the daytime of all kinds of people, even police officers walking with crowds of people.
Yeah,
there's none of this unity.
And actually, thank you so much for that. And I definitely want to hear David's response to that. Anne, thank you for your call. David, what do you think?
Well, you know, the classic stereotypical definition of news isn't the plane that lands safely. And so when there's violence and when there's conflict, TV cameras in particular, but journalists of all stripes gravitate toward that. At the same time, I do think that peaceful protest is and sustained peaceful protest is part of the news and a big part of the news, because the outrage is not simply localized. You know, there were other incidents leading up to George Floyd, some of them, importantly captured by Michelle earlier at the top of the show, that informed the reaction to this. And I think peaceful protest and sustained public outrage, the fact that people who have been at home and successfully at home during a pandemic to try to slow the spread of this contagious disease, deadly disease, have just sort of gone out into public, in even in states that have not eased the lockdown in any tremendous way, speaks to their anger and their anguish about all these things. And that is absolutely news. So, you know, it's a question of where you direct the attention. Our former colleague Robert Krulwich tells this incredible story of back when he was with ABC News, and he was talking about coverage of the toppling of a statue in Iraq and the way in which the TV cameras were capturing just, you know, these exultant, exuberant Iraqis celebrating the toppling of the statue of a tyrant of Saddam Hussein. And what he showed you is that there were also cameras that were farther back, that had pulled back farther, and showed you that essentially I believe it was U.S. Marines, had physically engineered almost the entire thing, but that they had wanted the Iraqis in the picture to make it look as though this was sort of an organic event. And he said, you know, this is true. There were Iraqis who were celebrating, and they were physically there. It is also true U.S. armed personnel were involved in the pulling down of the statue and the, in a sense, creation of the moment that was captured for television broadcast. And he did a story for ABC explaining that, which was a very smart deconstruction. Facts and larger truth are sometimes perfectly going in the same directions, and sometimes they cut against each other a little bit because we're focusing so much on one element that we don't see the larger picture.
Right. And so where cameras are pointed and what they choose to keep in the frame, both literally and metaphorically, versus what is cut out of the frame, and the editorial process that ends up putting pictures in on front pages of newspapers or on TV. Well, I guess what I want to say is that is something that requires it's a choice that's being made. And I heard carefully what you said earlier, David, about that right now this moment may be too much for the press to process, but the obligation to still do the best to try and provide as much context, even in something that's moving incredibly quickly, is still there, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I mean, you saw this piece in Slate that the Verge also did a version of, in which they essentially, you know, there have been so many stories about the protests and about the violence that has ensued from the protests, and there's real truth in that. I mean, you've seen looting, you've seen people doing attacking. You know, I think it was the mayor of Minneapolis said, you know, mostly these are, or perhaps the governor said, mostly these are people from outside, and news organizations came in and checked the home addresses and said, actually, most of these people are from around, you know, around here, sadly to say. It's not just all, you can't just assign all the arrests of people who are somehow conjured up from another place to make trouble. There's real violence there. And at the same time, what Slate and The Verge did was they framed it as, you know, over the past 72 hours, people across the U.S., this is the head of The Verge's story, have captured what may be the most comprehensive live picture of police brutality ever. Mm-hmm. And the Slate similarly talked about an explosion of violence, but focused on instances involving police officials, law enforcement officers. That is, the same factual reports were put together in a different way to say, you want to talk about a violence, this is a violence about people with badges. And both can be true, and sometimes one informs the other. And therefore, the press, in just doing, you know, narrowly defined clinical stories, can sometimes miss the larger truth. And it really has to, sometimes what journalistic outlets do is they do a pointillist approach. They do little tiles and added together, you know, small stories about the world in miniature, but added together, it adds up to a very comprehensive picture, like a larger mural of what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, we have to keep going back again and again to capture these things and to try to do so with a sense of humanity and fairness, while acknowledging that you know, it doesn't mean that everybody protesting is active in violence, and it doesn't mean everybody protesting is acting in a way that reflects justice either.
Mm. Yeah, Michelle, I keep thinking about this word that you used about the anguish and the continuing buildup of all that anguish. And I want to just play a moment from Atlanta, because during protests in Atlanta last week, some protesters threw stones or rocks through the entrance to one CNN center, of course, CNN based in Atlanta. And Atlanta's own Killer Mike, hip-hop star and activist, he spoke at a mayoral press conference on Friday and actually pointed to what he thinks is CNN's contribution to how people are feeling at this moment. And here is what Killer Mike said.
I love CNN. I love Cartoon Network. But I'd like to say to CNN right now, karma's a mother. Stop feeding fear and anger every day. Stop making people feel so fearful. Give them hope.
That's Killer Mike in Atlanta. Michelle, what do you think about that? He was pointing out very clearly his belief that, you know, media coverage itself, not even in just in this moment, but for a while, is contributing to why we're here now.
Well, you know, we live in a tumultuous moment. And so if you watch a steady stream of cable television, if you look at your timeline on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you know, source you get your news aggregation from, you would get the impression that everybody in America wakes up with their fists balled up every single day. It is very pugilistic, but to take what Killer Mike said and reach back to how David, you know, beautifully rendered the dilemma for American journalists right now. This is a very difficult story to cover because it is not a single story. Mm-hmm. We are seeing protests in different states and sometimes in different areas in the same city that are carried out in a different way. And so when you try to, Anne, when she posed her question, was talking about looking in newspapers. And the traditional model of a newspaper is to take one story, one picture, and that one picture encapsulates what happened that day. And then there's larger stories around it. But that picture is the thing that draws your attention. In cable news, often it's that one story that they're going to cover throughout the broadcast, and they're going to have a person on one side and a person on another side. It's really hard to approach these protests in that matter because, yes, you have questions about police, excessive policing, but you also have in several cities police who actually took a knee with the protesters. Mm-hmm. Astonishing photos of silence where there are actually people in riot gear down on one knee, showing a moment of respect and solidarity with the protesters that are there to protest police brutality. How do you tell both of those stories at the same time? And that's one of the challenges that we face. And if we don't get that right, we will have, we will contribute to the sort of the long tail of blame that will be assessed in this moment. And we learned that, for instance, from past uprisings, from even after the Kent State shooting, the American public largely, you know, the poll showed that they believed that the guard was in their right to do that because of their view of policing. And the study showed following that it had a lot to do with the coverage of the moment. So it's really incumbent upon us to get this right, but it's very difficult to do when the story has so many facets in so many different places.
Mm. Well, I want to play another moment from, this was from Morning Edition, at the protests near the White House yesterday. Morning Edition spoke to a father who gave his first name as Shay, who had come to watch over his daughter, and Shay told Morning Edition that he preferred that protests remain peaceful. But on the other hand, he said, violent protest is an American tradition going back to the founding of this nation.
Look, America has been founded on violence. America is a violent place. If you go back to that Boston Tea Party, right, we're protesting. It's a rebellion. And so we're living in a modern age rebellion. And so, yeah, it's going to be dirty and there's going to be people against it. But we're living in a 2020 rebellion.
Michelle, respond to that.
I think the use of the word rebellion is interesting. If you look at the coverage of this, these gatherings around the country are usually described as riots. And I guarantee you that if you went out and actually talked to people who are holding signs, who are marching in the street, whether they're doing the quiet protest during the day or the more chaotic protests in the evening, very few of them would actually call what they're doing rioting. Many of them would use the word uprising. They would use the word rebellion. They would use the word resistance. And I find it interesting that he used that term to describe what was going on, because that speaks to the mindset of what people are doing. They're not necessarily there to tear up their own communities. People in moments like this always ask, why would people tear up their own community? That community doesn't feel like it's their own in the first place. They don't feel like they have agency over their safety, over the degree of opportunity that they might have in life. And so what they're doing is actually rebelling against a system, rebelling against an America that has never really embraced them. And that's what I hear in his statement. Mm.
David, your thoughts?
I think that's right. I think back to, I was a very junior reporter during the Rodney King riots, and I'm from Southern California, but I was reporting in North Carolina, and there was a spirited argument where I had covered a local event. I think it was done sort of a Durham, North Carolina, Duke University event, and one of the things the organizers said to me as a reporter there is, you cannot call these riots. This is rebellion. It's an uprising. It's this and that. And so I said, is there a way to talk about an explosion of violence and you know, protest and unrest, instead of using the word violence to capture what's happening, but do it? And the head of the copy desk at that time, very tough-minded woman, said, these are riots, and you need to use that word. You've got to do justice to what actually happened. And I understood her point, and I understood their point. It's that you have to capture the intent of what people are doing, and you also have to capture what actually happened, and what happened was violent and in some cases terrible. And there is violence here. You know, there was a place I sometimes would go for a sandwich in Washington, D.C. back when I worked down there, called Teaism. You know, its owner, it was basically, the glass was shattered. It was pretty banged up and ruined from the pictures I saw, and its owner put out a statement saying Black Lives Matter. She cared about the political import. You know, nonetheless, you know, they weren't people, whoever did that wasn't acting against the owner of that particular restaurant. It was just lashing out at storefronts that represented what was perceived to be presumably a hostile establishment. And you saw, you know, tensions outside the White House, which is the ultimate authority, and those lights go out. Amazingly, when the president was taken, no doubt for security concerns, downstairs in a protective bunker underneath down there. But, you know, it's sort of a misdirected and expression of anger and anguish, as Michel has said. But, you know, it is fair to reflect that, and it's also important to capture what's happening as part of the dynamic and not to paper over it either.
Yeah. Well, we've just got about a minute and a half left. And Michel, I want to turn this last question to you. Race is one of those core issues in America that, in order for us to understand it, to grapple with it, all of us, it requires nuance, complexity, space to be thoughtful, patience, openness, all the things that are very hard to do in convulsive moments like this. So in the last 60 seconds we've got, do you have tips on pointers on where to look for that kind of that space?
I will try to be quick, and I will add fortitude to that list.
Yes.
Because it's tough. We often focus on moments of race, on the subject of race, when the tornado is at our back, when in fact it's the wind that blows across our shoulders all the time. It's always with us. And so to understand it, you have to understand it all the time. You have to lean into it all the time. And you have to understand that it's not just for reporters of color, that all of us are raced in some way. We all check a box on the census. It's a story that belongs to all of us.
Well, Michel Norris is founding director of the Race Card Project, an opinions contributor for The Washington Post, and author of The Grace of Silence, a memoir, and of course, many of you know her from her work formerly at NPR. It's been such an honor to speak with you, Michel. Thank you.
Magna, thank you. And good to be with you, David.
And David Fogenflik, On Point Friday host and NPR media correspondent. David, it was great to have you back. Thank you.
My great pleasure.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.